Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Denise Kiernan. She lives in Asheville. She is the best-selling author of The Girls of Atomic City, which was about the secret city of Oak Ridge and the nine women who were a part of that effort. Her latest book is The Last Castle, the epic story of love, loss, and American royalty in the nation's largest home. That home is the Biltmore House in Asheville. And so we persuaded her to come talk about her book and about the family that built it and the family that lived in it, at least for a time. And Denise Kiernan, welcome to Chapel Hill.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
It's great to have a mountain girl.
Yes,
down here,
yes.
In the lowlands.
Yes, yes.
There's so many things to talk about. Can we talk first about your new book?
Absolutely, yes. I'd be happy to.
Why is this book called The Last Castle?
You know, when I first began my idea file, right? I keep a gazillion idea files when I get an idea for something I think it is I might want to do down the line. Stow them away, come back to them, revisit them. When I first started thinking about doing something on Biltmore House, it just really occurred to me over and over, nothing like it had ever existed before it, and nothing like it has ever come to be since. There has never been anything like it. And also, the book, you know, starts really at the height of the Gilded Age, end of the 19th century. And then we move into the Progressive Era. We get into, you know, Prohibition and women's rights. And America is really at this just amazing point of transformation. And I'm personally fascinated by America during that transformation at the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century. And for many people who had these elaborate homes, who lived this lifestyle, it was the end of a very, very specific age. And so really there's never been anything like it. And it also, to me, felt like we've also never had a time in America since like we did during the Gilded Age.
Well, a lot of us here a good ways from Asheville, we hear about the Biltmore House, but we don't go there and pay, what is it, $85 now or
sure.
whatever it is to see it. But in the old days, when you get it for $5, some
or
of us
two, when they opened in 1930, it was $2. Yeah.
But tell us, what is it about the house that attracts people today?
Well, you know, you talk about people over here, you know, in the other part of the state not necessarily being familiar with the house or, you know, going there on an annual basis. I travel a lot for my books, and I've done a fair amount of traveling for The Last Castle, and I'm always amazed. There are people in other parts of the country who've never even heard of Biltmore House, let alone not visited it, know absolutely nothing about it. And I think there is that, I don't want to say surface level of just the size and the grandeur, but that is certainly an attraction for a lot of people to be able to say, I've been in the biggest house ever in the United States of America, and oh my gosh, they have their own bowling alleys, and they have an indoor swimming pool, and they had that in the 1890s. How's that possible? But also it's the setting and the immersive quality. For me, when you step in the door to the house, actually, when you first start driving onto the estate property, even today, and the estate is much smaller than it was, you know, 100 or so years ago, you really feel the effort that landscape architect Frederick Law Olmsted put into your approach.
It was just, it's not an accident that you feel that way.
He was so much attention went to the approach road and how people would feel driving in there and then suddenly turning, you know, to the right, and you have this huge, great reveal of your destination, you know, getting to Biltmore House itself. And from the moment you start driving in there, you really do feel like you're going into another world, to another place. When you step inside the house, honestly, it's like stepping into a giant time capsule. You know, so many of the family's possessions and furnishings and tapestries and art are still in the house. That you really feel like you're visiting someone at the turn of the 20th century. Unlike, I mean, a lot of wonderful historic homes don't have that. They have had to rely on accumulating period appropriate furnishings to, you know, to make the house, you know, feel a little bit more full. But, you know, you walk into Biltmore House and you feel like you're visiting the family. So that's part of it. But also for me, a lot of it is just the grounds and the surroundings and the forests as well.
Well, let's talk about how it came about. And you look at it, and even those of us who don't understand its context, we know that it took a lot of money to build it.
Sure.
And talk about the family. Where did that money come from?
Well, so George Vanderbilt was the grandson of Cornelius the Commodore Vanderbilt. Cornelius had, you know, nothing when he was a kid. He grew up with next to nothing. And then from a lot of hard work and some awfully shrewd, sometimes questionable business practices, he amassed a fortune in shipping and railroads.
He's the Vanderbilt that created the money.
He is the papa of the fortune.
He made the money.
He made it. That's right. He made it. He didn't inherit it. He made it. And he was very scrappy and just created this huge fortune. And then he left the bulk of that to his son, William Henry. William Henry took his inheritance and more than doubled it in no time flat.
How did he was for either lucky or a good businessman too?
Well, if you look at, and there are some wonderful biographies on Cornelius Vanderbilt and early generations of the Vanderbilt family, you know, William Henry had to really go out of his way. He was not the initial chosen son, and he really had to go out of his way to kind of prove himself to his father.
So you tell that story in your book. And
he
exiled him to some farm or some place.
Yeah,
that
he
was
said, you know, it was like, you've always been, you know, ill health or whatever. Go take this acreage and, you know, get out of my way. And he just, I really think it was sort of like this gauntlet was laid down and William Henry said, well, watch this, you know.
It was like the parable in the Bible of the talents that this kid, different from any other of the Vanderbilt descendants, really, he took his what he had and doubled, as you say.
Yeah, and really just went to town with it. And George was William Henry's youngest
son. Now George is the central character,
or yes.
One of the central
yes,
characters
of
this story. George
yeah.
is the guy who decided to, instead of living
Why
in—
Why work for the company and live in—yeah, sure.
But he did—he spent the money.
He did. So, and as did other— his siblings. But, you know, George, and if you look at Cornelius II was George's oldest brother, and between them was nearly, I mean, Cornelius was old enough to be George's father, his older brother was. So George was, you know, the baby of the family, obviously did not have to lift a finger to do anything ever because they had more money than you could. William Henry was believed at one point to be the richest man in the world, let alone, you know, New York. And George had no interest in working for the company, working for the Vanderbilt Railroad and Shipping Empire. He frankly spent his time the way I would if I didn't have to work for a living.
No, you wouldn't. I mean, wouldn't George?
He read books all the time.
I know, but
and
I mean,
traveled and I know.
George's. I guess we have to say that George. If it weren't for George, Biltmore would never be there, and we wouldn't have this wonderful asset. But I mean, wouldn't you say George was weird?
He was definitely marching to his own beat for sure. He was so just followed such a different path. I mean, I sometimes think if he had just been left to his own devices, I don't know if he would have ever done anything except, you know, read books and travel and go to the theater. And you know, he was philanthropic. He actually you know, helped start the Jackson Library in New York, which became the precursor to the New York Public Library. But I mean, he just he did not seem to want to do anything having to do with what not only just his brothers, but some of his brothers-in-law were actually doing. Obsessively kept track of what books he read and got so picky about book bindings that he would send them off to this one particular binder in Paris to have them bound. And when he— You know, for him to decide, oh, I'm not going to build a house in Newport. You know, I'm not going to build a house in the Berkshires. I'm going to build it in Western North Carolina.
Denise Kiernan, let's take a break and then come back and talk about how
he ended up here.
How he made the decision and how he implemented it. And if you joined us late, I'm visiting with Denise Kiernan, and we're talking about her new book, The Last Castle, and she and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and I'm visiting with Denise Kiernan, and she is the author of The Last Castle. It's just recently been the paperback edition has recently been on the bookshelves. But in the meantime, the hardback was a New York Times bestseller. It's a very successful book. And for those of you cheapskates who always wait until the paperback come out, the time is now to come, is to buy that book, buy this book. We're talking about the Vanderbilt family. And if it weren't for the money that the Vanderbilt family had made, the Biltmore House would never have been built.
Absolutely not, yeah.
You told us about George Vanderbilt. He's the grandson of the Commodore. He had a lot of money, and he wanted to spend it in a special way.
In a very special way.
Why did he choose North Carolina to build his house?
You know, one of the things George loved to do, and many people of his station loved to do in their ample spare time, was travel. It seems like, okay, well, people were coming to Asheville in the late 1800s. People were coming to this area, to the Asheville area in the late 1800s. It was actually not terribly unusual for moneyed families up and down the East Coast to head to the mountain areas, the Blue Ridge Mountains, Smoky Mountains, because the air was believed to be curative. So if you were suffering from symptoms related to tuberculosis or malaria, you would come down. There's this wonderful little cottage industry that's sprung up in a lot of areas in the Blue Ridge Mountains, Smoky Mountains, including the Asheville area. Doctors would treat patients who would travel from far and wide. And part of that treatment was, of course, to sit on what became known as breathing porches, where you know what you did? You breathed. And that was it. And people are to a certain extent paying for this kind of treatment. So in 1888, George comes down with his mom, and they were very, very, very close. And while she's, you know, breathing on a porch, George gets on a horse and he's riding around and he's quite enchanted with the scenery and the vistas and things of that nature. And so under the names of various agents and assumed names, and he starts buying up pieces of property and accumulating land. And
what's he think? Is he thinking about a house, or is he just thinking about,
he is thinking about a house. He was, because of his mother's health, and he was considered to be of frail health as well. They were looking for a place outside of New York, someplace with a milder climate, perhaps. So they were actually looking for a retreat of sorts, and ideally a retreat in a healthier climate.
Where did they stay? Where would you stay in Asheville in the late 1890s?
Oh, they stayed at what was the Battery Park Hotel, the wonderful Battery Park Hotel. And the original Battery Park Hotel is not there anymore. Another one was built on the same site. But yes, they stayed at this very grand Battery Park Hotel. It had a cigar porch. I love that they were you were either going out to breathe for your tuberculosis or you're out there to smoke cigars. Probably both at the same time. It had a house orchestra. You know, it had lovely views because of where it was situated. So, yes, they stayed at the Battery Park Hotel during that trip when he, you know, fell in love with the area. Probably just stepped out on his balcony and was like, yes, I'll take it.
It's hard. I know you must have tried to get inside his mind to figure out what was going on and how that decision was made.
Yeah,
he says,
sure,
this is a beautiful place. I could be not just one of many rich people. I could be the big-time richest person.
That could be part of it. I also think that he was looking for some way to sort of distinguish himself from his brothers. And it also is important to note that for a lot of these individuals, you know, today we talk about the 1%. So back then they talked about the 400, you know, the number of people who supposedly could comfortably fit into Carolyn Astor's ballroom. So if you made the ballroom party cut, you were the creme de la creme of society. And a lot of these folks, you know, the way that they did sort of compete socially was, look at this house. Look at this cottage I have in Newport. Oh, I got John Singer Sargent to do an oil of my daughter. Oh, I got James Whistler. They all, you know, artistic commissions. Now, on the upside, this kind of patronage led to supporting some tremendous artists of the time. And, you know, architects, highly lauded architects were in great demand. So to me, it sort of made sense that a guy who was not working, who did not need to work, who had such an incredible, William Henry, his father, had an amazing art collection. George grew up with a really great artistic sense, that he would want to go down that route and have some sort of very, very special home.
So you wanted to build a museum.
In some ways, that is almost like what he set out to do. When he decided on Richard Morris Hunt, the architect, and Hunt.
Tell us about Hunt. I mean, a little bit about Hunt.
Oh, yeah. Here. So Richard Morris Hunt was arguably the most renowned architect of the Gilded Age.
He was the guy that they wanted to do in New York and Newport. Yes.
If you wanted a fancy house in Newport or on Fifth Avenue in New York City at the turn of the century or early, you know, late 1800s, you wanted Richard Morris Hunt. And he had already done George's older brother, Frederick, who was married to Alva, who went on to be a very interesting suffragist. He had done their house on Fifth Avenue, the Petit Chateau, to just raves from Architectural Digest and all these other places. And George had worked with Hunt on the family mausoleum on Staten Island as well. And George really admired him. And Hunt was the first American to ever graduate from the École des Beaux-Arts in Paris. He was quite well known on two continents. So it was kind of a natural choice for George.
So imagine that conversation between the two of, I don't just a house like we got in New York. I want a castle. Is that what he said?
I actually don't think that's how it happened. Although it's funny to talk about project creep, but sometimes I think that's some of what happened. So. You know, George and Hunt's wife actually traveled to Europe for inspiration. And, you know, they go to the Loire Valley, among other spots in England and France and elsewhere. And Loire Valley has all these beautiful French chateaus. And some of those chateaus, you can see really elements of inspiration from those in Biltmore House, especially when you look at the facade. So they're looking at all these wonderful places for inspiration. There was an old sketch early on in the process, and the title of it, I have it in the book. I might mess it up a bit. Something along the lines of Mr. Vanderbilt's old colonial house. And it was not 175,000 square feet. It was significantly
a big house,
smaller.
But not the gigantic castle.
No, it was more in line of, I think it might have even been under 20,000 square feet or around
so
there.
So I love that you say this is project creep and it just got bigger and bigger.
You ever
and bigger
done that? I mean, you know, like, I'm going to change the sink in this bathroom. Oh, you know what? I have always hated this tile. Well, you know, as long as we're taking the tile out, I'd really rather have a walk-in shower than this bathtub. And so that's project creep for most of us humans. So just imagine if you think, well, I would really like a nice, you know, country home. Well, Frederick Law Olmsted is going to do the landscape architecture. And, you know, he did Central Park. And, you know, well, why don't we get some really nice gardens going? Okay, let's get some more land. Well, I want to rejuvenate these forests. These forests need a lot of help. Yes, let's bring in a forester. But, you know, the house really needs to be able to hold its own against this backdrop. And, you know, there's Mount Pisgah. And remember that, you know, chateau we saw? So you can just imagine you have this young man looking for a project who was in love with art, who was in love with architecture. And then you have an architect who has a client who seems to have, a lot of money to spend. So it's an interesting little combination.
When do you think in the project that the cost the accelerating, escalating cost of the project got to be a worry for anybody?
You know, that's an interesting question. There is when they actually opened the house to family and friends in 1895, and this was after roughly about 6 years of construction. Parts of it were still not finished. The music room hadn't been finished. Actually, in 1895, his library hadn't been finished, which I thought was hilarious because, you know, he was such a fan of books. And then construction continued, and he also started traveling. And so there started to be things appearing in the paper that, you know, one of his brothers had warned him about spending too much money and things of that nature. So I personally think, based on those sorts of reports and other things that I picked up, like they just kind of stopped working on certain aspects of the house. They began to make
budget decisions.
Yes, it started. You can see concern for money begin to come in. There was an entire project that Olmsted wanted to do that never saw the light of day. I think some of that had to do with finances, and then they just began to cut back. But of course, cutting back for them is a little different than cutting back for most of us.
If you joined us late, Denise Kiernan is telling us about the construction of the Biltmore House in Asheville, which is the topic of her new book, The Last Castle. She and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. If you did join us late, we're talking about the Biltmore House up in Asheville. Almost every North Carolinian knows about it and heard about it. You don't know about it, really, until you've read The Last Castle or listened to this conversation with Denise Kiernan, the author of the book. And we've gotten your central character, at least in the early part of the book, George Vanderbilt, who came down here to Asheville or came down to North Carolina. Saw some beautiful property, bought it, and he wanted to put a castle on it, and he did. And so he got his house built. Then what happened?
Well, it was in danger of becoming, you know, the biggest man cave ever. You know, it takes bachelor pad to a whole other level. And
so he was building this, not married. He's a bachelor, and he's building a hundred mm-hmm. and is it 175
for him and his mother? For him and his mother.
So. Really, all he needs
and friends,
is a small apartment, but he's built a big hotel size.
Yeah, with the idea that they'd have parties and visitors and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, 250 rooms is you can do.
You've made it quite
space.
Clear that this is the largest house in America.
Yes.
And what comes close?
Ah. That's a good question. Ohika, and I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Yeah. I've actually never heard anybody pronounce it. Ohika Castle in New York is second at 109,000 square
and
feet.
And what family built that?
I honestly do not even remember. And because I wanted to look all of this up because I like playing a little game with people, which is especially when I'm not in the South. What do you think the largest house in the country is? And what do you think everybody guesses?
White House. I have no idea.
Some people guess White House, but the one that gets guessed, the people most often guess Hearst Castle in San Simeon.
Yeah.
And that's roughly 60,000.
60,000.
So we're talking almost a little over a third the size of Biltmore. It's not necessarily outside of this part of the country, not necessarily the first
None of the other first families, that is the Astors or the other Vanderbilts. They built big houses, but they're gone, right? I mean, are there not houses anymore? I mean, does any of those families have a house?
Well, Newport, the best place to see examples of some of these homes all in one place is to go to Newport. And a lot of these summer cottages in Newport are wonderful to visit. And you can take tours and, that's a group of people's summer homes. And many of those are, you know, 30, 40, 50, 60,000 square feet. And they're spectacular.
And
their Marble House is really beautiful. But when you think about Fifth Avenue, and I mentioned the Petit Chateau on Fifth Avenue that George's older brother Frederick and his wife Alva had. A spectacular home, gone. George's childhood home, 640 Fifth Avenue, gone. A lot of places met with wrecking balls.
Any remnants of the Astors?
Gosh, that's a good question. I should know the answer to that. I don't know.
I mean, we have the name.
There must be. I mean, they must have. I don't know. I feel like I should be Googling right now, but I don't do that. That's
no,
okay.
But we're talking about the
Biltmore
House.
That's all right. That's all right. I don't know. I've learned long ago. I don't know is an okay answer to questions. can't know everything.
This is not a quiz.
Yeah.
But now let's move to another topic, and that is the house is built.
Mm-hmm.
And so the house is built. They move in and live in it. What does it take to make that house livable? In the way of servants, in the way of supplies, in the way of electricity or
supplies and electricity. The electric system there is quite astounding. It also had internal heating. The debate between alternating current and direct current was still raging at the time. So they put both in at that house. One of the things that I find interesting about Biltmore House is from the outside, I mentioned they got so much inspiration from some chateaus in the Loire Valley in France. And really from the outside, it is so reminiscent of these great European estates and chateaus. But it was actually incredibly technologically advanced for the time. So it really kind of straddled these two worlds. It didn't, for those Downton Abbey fans, listening, you weren't tugging on a string to ring a bell to call somebody. There were electric call buzzers. You could be in the indoor swimming pool, push a button and get a sandwich, And they had electric dumb waiters. They had central heating. Hunt was the brains behind a lot of this. Both Hunt and Olmsted, were very much in demand. They were at the height, actually at the end of their careers while they were working on this house. And they were also working on a little project called the 1893 World Fair in Chicago. So a lot of times they were giving very, very specific instructions to representatives on site when they couldn't physically be in Asheville at Biltmore House working. Richard Sharp Smith. It's very important to have three names, apparently. Frederick Law Olmsted, Richard Morris Hunt, Richard Sharp Smith. Richard Sharp Smith was the supervising architect and Hunt's second in command. An Englishman who actually fell in love with the area. He came down from New York to work with Hunt, fell in love with the area, stayed, and actually if you go to Asheville and go around some of the historic neighborhoods, he really left his mark on that town. You can see some really spectacular examples of Richard Sharp Smith's architecture, and it was Biltmore House that brought him down there. Yeah.
Before we take a break, George Vanderbilt, for those who joined us late, he's the guy who funded the building of Biltmore. But he was a bachelor. He was a confirmed bachelor. Kind of looking like maybe he might not ever get married. What happened, and who is this? Did he ever get married?
He did to Edith Stuyvesant Dresser, who is one of the main inspirations for me to write this book in the first place. She was. Stuyvesant being a very important part of her name. She was a direct descendant of Peter Stuyvesant, the last Dutch governor of New York. She was as old New York as you could get from a lineage standpoint. Did not have the same kind of financial resources that George did. Few people did. She endured some really trying times as a young woman. Lost her parents, just really had some tough times and ended up eventually being raised by her her governess. She, to me, is really the heart of this story. And I actually begin the book with her. It was really important to me to show her as a young woman, an independent woman, an unmarried woman before she simply just becomes referred to as Mrs. George Vanderbilt, mistress of Biltmore House. And she had such a resilience and a real kind of way with people that I think sort of in really helped endear the family to the community in and around Biltmore Village when she finally, you know, marries George in 1898.
Did you feel like she kind of became a mountain girl? This woman from, you know,
from Newport, Paris, New York. Yeah. Edith, to me, I mean, you talk about people blooming where they're planted to a certain extent. You know, here is a woman who, you know, was raised in New York, in Newport, lived with her sisters in Paris, had traveled to South America, you know, and she marries one of the most sought after bachelors in the country. And yes, they still had their place on Fifth Avenue in New York, but he brings it here. We are Biltmore House in Asheville. And instead of just sort of treating it like this is our, you know, holiday retreat, or I'm just going to kind of sit here on my estate and have a nice time and throw tea parties. I mean, she was in the village getting to know people. She was fascinated with the culture and the crafts and the people who were there. She wasn't, you know, sitting behind her gate writing checks, you know, for people who needed it. She'd get on a horse with a basket with blankets and food and go visit a sick employee or go see the spouse of an employee who was pregnant. I mean, that kind of sort of walking the walk impresses me in the 21st century. When you think about the mistress of the largest house in America doing it in the early 1900s, you know, she was something else. And she really seemed to kind of come into her own. And maybe it was because they were so far away from what was a very suffocating society in New York.
Let me ask you this. When, as you were gathering your thoughts about writing this book, when did she bite you? That is, when did, instead of this being the George Vanderbilt and family project, that you said, no.
I don't think I would have done, I don't think I would have done this book if I didn't want to kind of latch on to not just Edith, but also the kind of forestry history and everything that went on at Biltmore. But Edith was the number one driver for me because I didn't want this to just, it's not really a book just about the house. What I wanted to do was sort of use Biltmore as almost as a lens through which to examine America at the turn of the 20th century. A lot of what went on there, you could see reflected in other parts of the country. A lot of the financial crises that happened, changing tax laws, these houses, you know, falling to wrecking balls, people dealing with World War I, people dealing with the Great Depression, and women coming into their own. And you really see that through Edith's journey. So it was sort of like Edith bit me first, and then I thought, okay, this could be a really, really interesting book if I really make it about individuals like Edith and really kind of just step back and look at what this says about really says about America.
Well, if you joined us late, I'm visiting with Denise Kiernan. We're talking about her book, The Last Castle. It's about Biltmore, and we just had this wonderful conversation about maybe the woman who actually saved Biltmore from for us. And Denise and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Denise Kiernan. She's the author of The Last Castle. The subtitle is The Epic Story of Love, Loss, and American Royalty in the Nation's Largest Home. All of that in North Carolina, Asheville. It's the Biltmore House. You've heard about it. And if you want to know more, keep listening or buy the book.
Buy the book, sure.
It's out in paperback now. You can get it for relatively, you can get it for a whole lot less than the hardback cost. Tell us about the family that George and Edith created at Biltmore House. Did they have children?
Yes. In 1900, they brought Cornelia into the world, their only child, a daughter. And I always think it's very interesting that they chose to have her in Asheville, at Biltmore House, actually. They still had the home in New York. They spent time in Newport with family. They spent time in Washington, D.C., but they decided to have her in at Biltmore. And I really think that doing that on a certain level cemented their relationship with the community. People were very excited there was going to be a baby
like
on the
royalty,
estate.
Like
sort
the,
of, yes. They wrote poems to her in the newspaper. They brought presents. They nicknamed her Tar Heel Nell, which, you know, North Carolina, that's a pretty nice, that's a pretty big compliment to be given a Tar Heel nickname. And they also, you know, some of the outside press, like people in New York at other areas, called her, some of them called her the Hillbilly Heiress. And so she sort of did kind of complete this sort of fairy tale tableau of this family living in this grand magical looking home.
We know the people who run the or who own the Biltmore estate remnants are the Cecils. How did the Cecils come into this? The story.
So when Cornelia was 24, she married John Francis Amherst Cecil. And so she became a Cecil to a certain extent. She was Cecil by marriage. And they had two sons, George and William. And so Biltmore House is still privately owned and still in the family. It's still privately owned and still in the family. The Bill Jr., William Jr., who is the son of – who would be Cornelia's grandson, currently oversees operations at the estate. And so a lot of people, when you think about some of these historic homes and places like Williamsburg or, again, you know, I've mentioned the Newport Mansions before, those are nonprofits. You know, Biltmore remains a privately held family-run business.
It's family. There's sort of two – is it sort of divided into two areas of responsibility, sort of the real estate – and
right.
then the management
so,
of the
yes. The, so at the height of George's holdings, you know, we were looking at about 120,000, 125,000 acres. That's bigger than Washington, D.C. And after George's death, in the vicinity of 90,000 acres of that went to the federal government and formed the basis of Pisgah National Forest, which is wonderful, huge preservation effort there. And then when Cornelia's sons came into the picture, they essentially sort of divided the responsibilities. And the sons and how specifically they divided wasn't a huge focus of my book. Mm-hmm. But one sort of took over the dairy, Biltmore Dairy, and various real estate holdings. And the other focused sort of exclusively on the house itself, and you know, trying to make it a successful
well,
tourist destination,
really,
which
this,
I think they did.
They did, and it's only a small part of almost an afterwards in your book. But this is of great interest to us, is
sure.
to how they manage that, and is
it's
it
astounding.
In solid hands now?
I think so. I do. I think the fact that Biltmore exists today, first of all, is because of Edith, because you had so many of these houses, you know, falling away, and she was constantly seeking advice and ways to make sure that they could move forward, keeping the house intact and keeping, you know, some of the land intact, and also not making sure that it was, you know, sold off willy-nilly and overdeveloped and all that sort of stuff, because they did love that land.
Well, she did have to make some, and the families
she
had to make a lot of compromises.
Did. So. Oh, yeah. But it's almost like these efforts that were made bought just enough time for the house to go from being kind of this, you know, limestone albatross to becoming – it existed long enough that it started to be a real historic curiosity. So it sort of almost got through this sort of awkward teenage phase in a sense, and then suddenly it was like the last thing standing of its kind. And to still have all that land surrounding it and those gardens and – but, you know, even that, when the sons, Cornelia's sons, came back and started looking at trying to make it successful, it was tough for them, you know. They're planting their own geraniums. They're making their own brochures and losing money left and right. And but they stuck with it.
Gosh, maybe another book. It's great. I love your image of how you like to see the Biltmore estate, and that is in I don't know, in a
From a kayak.
From a kayak.
I love seeing it from a kayak. I do. I like kayaking on the French Broad, and you see various Asheville's changed so much since I've lived there about 12 years now. It's changed so much, developed a lot. But whenever you hit, when you hit the estate, the French Broad runs right through it. It gets very quiet and just really kind of magical.
You got to state on both sides. You have to
yeah,
state on
both yeah. sides. It's on both sides of the river, and it's lovely.
Now what if you park your kayak on
you know,
estate?
I asked that question once. I yelled to a guy on the bank, and I said, "I'm a pass holder. Can I tie off here and just go for a walk?" They said, "No."
Well, listen, there's so many other questions I've got to ask you. This is a wonderful book, and the problem with it is it spurs, instead of just learning things, you've taught me all the things I don't know that I need to know now. So you got to write some more books.
Absolutely. And then I get to come back, right?
You come back whenever okay. you want, and bring your husband with you when I talk about his mystery stories. Thanks for coming, Denise Kiernan. Thanks for coming to visit us in Chapel Hill and tell us about your book.
Thank you so much.
If you joined us late, my guest has been Denise Kiernan. We've been talking about her great book, The Last Castle. She'll be back soon, but I'll be back before you know it.